he wouldn't stop at a new trick or two. He changed the show tremendously and always added tremendously to it. And I met people all my life. They're going away now because Thurston last performed in 1935. So those people who saw him, there are very few now who remember seeing him. But when I was growing up, I always had memories of people would tell me their memories of the Thurston show. The princess that floated in the middle of the stage, the ball that would float over the stage and into the audience, the spirits that appeared in the spirit cabinet, him throwing playing cards up into the balcony of the theater. He did an illusion called Aesia, which was a woman who went into a prayer cage, and the cage was lifted out over the heads of the audience.
Oh my!
It was rigged over the audience, and the cabinet went up to the ceiling of the theater and then fell open, and she was gone.
See, and this is in late 1800, early 1900 technology.
His career was in the late 1800s. When he was working in America as the great magician, it was between 1908 and 1936. Those tricks were from the 20s. Yeah.
That is amazing. How did he come up with this?
He was always, always looking for new ideas and always kept people on their toes developing ideas for him. He was one of the first magicians in America to present the illusion of sawing a woman in half. And it was a huge feature in his show. I mean, it was a great comedy number, and a huge bit of presentation for him. And he presented it from 1921 until 1936, and he always included it. And in his programs, it always said, by public request, sawing a woman in half. And it was by public request. It was something everyone wanted to see. And Thurston did it unlike anybody else.
I bet it was one of the tricks he would probably perform right at the end, just as a great show. A showbuster, wasn't it?
He would always move things around, and he was very conscious about where things were placed in the show to create the maximum effect. It's funny that you say that. He usually ended his show with a big spectacle, but right before that, he would do something really sweet and intimate. For many, many years, he did a trick where he would produce a rabbit and then offer to give it to a little girl in the audience, and when he wrapped it up, it would change into a box of candy.
He and created the awe effect, didn't he?
He always, always played to get the personality across to the audience, and he always intermixed that with the great big spectacle pieces so that people didn't lose him in the middle of it.
Was it easy to research him when you wrote the book, The Last Greatest Magician in the World, or was it difficult?
Boy, you know, there were so many great magic collectors and historians and people who were interested in the subject, and I really benefited from the collections of several of those people. There's a collector in New York, Rory Feldman, and one in Ohio, Ken Klosterman, and Mike Caveney in Los Angeles, good friends of mine who had tremendous collections of Thurston material and had been putting together letters and pictures and diaries and notebooks over the years. And there really were dozens of collectors that I benefited from over the years. And so the research was fun to do, and everybody had some treasures that they were willing to share. And the story was put together really like a jigsaw puzzle.
You said he was kind of obsessed about Indian magic. Tell me about this.
Well, early in his travels, when he took this big show out, he traveled. He started going from the west coast of America to Australia, and then he was determined to take it through the Orient. And he went up to China, and then he decided to go to India. And everyone told him, "You can't go to India. Don't go to India." This was about 1905, 1907, and they said, "You can't take a show of that size to India." And in fact, the only way he did it was he had his own tent made so that he could ensure that the theater was large enough and that it was to his specifications because the show was so elaborate. But when he got to India, he was obsessed with the idea of seeing real Indian magic. And he had all of the great Indian street magicians brought to his hotel so that he could see what they were doing. And when they weren't good enough, he insisted on meeting a real Indian yogi, you know, someone who had said that he had mastered these skills, and interviewing him and talking to him and finding out what he could do. And he was told that this man, after a diet of sheep's blood and meditation and fasting, he would be able to actually levitate for him. But Thurston never actually saw that happen. But he was always interested in those phenomena all through his life. And he told his company that if he saw something like that, that they should be ready. He would leave the show and he would learn what those wise men knew, and he would devote his life to that. And he wouldn't keep going with his tour. That was so important to him. If he really saw something like that, that he would stop his career and learn it.
Jim, did he delve into the supernatural as Harry Houdini did?
He you know, Houdini was both a friend and an enemy, you know, a rival and a business associate all their lives. They started kind of at the same level in World's Fair in 1893. Houdini had a completely different approach. Houdini, you know, was an arch skeptic and really took on the issue of spiritualism.
Right.
Thurston always kept an open mind about it. He has a very, very funny, fluid kind of faith all through his career. He was always interested in the subject. He always said that he believed that those things are possible, but that he hadn't seen it. At various times, he said he had seen things that were completely unexplainable. He's had him sitting with a medium, an Italian medium, who clearly fooled him very badly. I mean, he had no idea how it was done. And he vouched for her and said that he thought that some of the things that she did were genuine. He ended up being slightly more skeptical, and he thought that anything that was done for money, anything that was done kind of on demand, probably wasn't real. But he still held out the faith that there was real, genuine psychic phenomenon. And over that point, he and Houdini disagreed violently.
Most people have heard the name Houdini. Why haven't we all heard about Howard Thurston?
Well, it's really interesting. In their day, I have it on authority of the people who worked for them, who were their contemporaries. In their day, he was as well known, if not better known, than Houdini. First of all, they were in two completely different markets. Houdini, most of his career, was working in vaudeville, and he did an escape act. He was known by the public generally as an escape artist. And so when Houdini was a star of vaudeville theaters and was known for getting out of things and known for these unbelievable publicity stunts, he really invented his own career in that way.
And the vaudeville theaters, just set the stage real quickly, Jimmy, for us. Mm-hmm. They would have like an orchestra there and...
They were first-class productions, but a vaudeville theater was about going in and seeing 12 acts that night. You know, there would be an opening act, there would be a juggler, there would be...
Okay.
You know, so they were short acts. And
maybe a host would come in and introduce them?
Yeah, actually, in vaudeville in those days, the MCs kind of came in later, kind of in the 30s. That sort of became part of that formula. But in the teens and the 20s, when vaudeville started, you know, that's the old thing where there would be a card at the side of the stage and announcing the name of the act, and they would change the card. There were electric annunciators. There were electric signs at the side that would flash with the names of the acts. And Houdini was a star, which means that Houdini... just about closed the show. He was right at the end of the show. And he would be, unlike the other acts who would have 10 minutes, Houdini would have 20 or 30 minutes. You know, he would have the feature spot. And the week after that, if you saw him in Chicago, he would get on the train with his assistants and he would go to Milwaukee and he would do the escape act in Milwaukee for a theater there. And then he would get on the train the next week and he would go to another vaudeville theater. So it was a circuit of theaters all across the country.
And he probably got a higher percent of the gate than some of the other vaudeville acts.
He was a very well-paid, he was at the top of the game and was really successful. And again, you know, he completely invented himself. And not only that, invented this whole thing of the escape artist. You know, there really wasn't anything like that before Houdini came along. There were some tricks involving getting out of rope ties, but the whole notion of presenting that as a feature was a novelty, and it really was Houdini who did that. You know, his whole personality took that on. He was a little man that you couldn't contain, you couldn't lock him down, you couldn't hold him. He would get out of anything, and there was a kind of pose in that. There was a sort of a swagger in it, and it really turned him into a sort of superhero.
Was Thurston ever in the same vaudeville show as Houdini?
They never worked together in the same show. They were absolutely in the same cities at the same time. When Thurston was doing his card act and when Houdini was doing his escape act, they were both stars of vaudeville at the same time. Thurston very quickly got out of vaudeville, and Houdini kept going for many years. But yes, they were. They were absolute contemporaries, and they were always nipping at each other's heels. You know, they were kind of friendly rivals who sometimes that rivalry boiled over. But there were always parallels in their career. They're always kind of at the same point. One's getting a little ahead, and then the other one catches up and gets a little ahead. So part of the fun of the story is this rivalry between these two performers.